Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clark, and I'm welcoming a new member to the book club, all the way from Los Angeles, but originally from Dublin. It's Mick Cassidy. Mick, welcome to the book club.
Well, good morning, Eamon. I'm delighted and excited to be here.
Well, it's a delight to have you. You reached out to me on Instagram and we managed to arrange a recording. As I say, it's evening time here in the UK. For you, it's morning in LA. But welcome. Now, first time on the book club. So you know how we start.
Yes.
We start with 2000 AD or comics origin stories. Tell us about your first comics.
My first comics were pretty much the same as yours, I'm sure, in Ireland. Lots of Beano, lots of Dandy. I had an older brother who would bring, you know, Warlord and 2000 AD, Star-Lord, everything into the house. And I even remember reading his first issue, well, 2000 AD issue one. And I remember him bringing it in, and I remember being enthralled by a guy gored on Old Will Eye's tooth, begging somebody to shoot him, and thinking, well, this is different. So, lots of Beano, lots of Dandy. Moved up to 2000 AD, never really looked back. That was really the only one that I, once I discovered it for myself, the only one I made a real issue about trying to get to every week.
And you say you're sort of a prog one-er then?
Well, my older brother was, I was too young at the time. I would have been six when 2000 AD came out first. So 81 was when I jumped in. Prog 224, Judge Death Lives.
Oh, wow.
Strontium Dog, The Gronk Affair.
Right.
And Nemesis was free, well, starting its third episode, although I didn't know that at the time. But man, that's an issue and a half to jump into.
224, well, yeah, I mean, you're in Golden Age territory there, aren't you?
Yeah. My next door neighbor had it, and I read his, and then I ran to the nearest newsagent to buy my own, and I just reread that thing over and over again. So,
well, I will ask you about possibly your sort of journey from Dublin to Los Angeles later on. We get to your own work, but you've mentioned it already. You've given us a little clue. What is the book that you've chosen to come on the book club with?
Oh, Nemesis. Nemesis book one. I mean, nothing else compares. I mean, as a kid, reading that comic for the first time and just being introduced to all those different artists, all those different stories, and every one of them pretty much punching you in the face as soon as you open the comic. But I think it was Nemesis that really made an impact. It was just so fucking weird and mysterious. And even just, I mean, 81, I would have been 10. So even as a 10-year-old, I just remember just being bowled over by how different it looked to anything else I'd seen at the time.
So if Sheridan's listening, I'm sure he is, we have chosen to do Nemesis the Warlock, the book one from the Titan editions, because Sheridan and I have previously done the Hachette editions. So we've gone right back to the beginning. We've got the Titan edition. I'd say that Nemesis the Warlock's been collected a few times, but
to say the least,
in the Titan version, we've got the stories that start in Prog 167 and go on and off to around Prog 244. We've got Pat Mills, we've got Kevin O'Neill, lettered by Steve Potter, editor Steve McManus, and an introduction in this volume by Nick Landau, who, of course, fans Titan. So, Mick, I know this is quite a personal one for you. Tell us about your first experiences with Nemesis, when you read these stories, about that punch in the face from the comics, and why you wanted to talk about it for the book club.
Well, I mean, I was unhealthily obsessed with Nemesis from the moment I started reading it. And I mean, in the sense that, I mean, at some point I almost felt like he was like an imaginary friend that used to like follow me everywhere. I mean, it was ridiculous looking back on it, but I was so, I was just so taken in by it, just by the story itself, by the way Nemesis looked. And then also, just by the artwork as well. I mean, I'd never seen anything like Kevin O'Neill's artwork. This is a bit of a tangent, I suppose, but I mean, I think there's a certain point there's different points in your life where you discover things that just really resonate with you personally. Just like, oh, this is my thing, you know? And it can be music, it can be movies, it can be books, it can be comic art, all that stuff, you know? But there's some stuff that just slots home so easily that you just know, oh, okay, that's it. And I think the thing that's really attractive as well when you're, you know, sort of coming into your teens, looking to find things that are going to help you define yourself as a person, I think there's something very attractive about, you know, when you're reading the likes of Beano or Dandy, you know, the brother bringing home maybe Battle or Warlord and stuff, although I've never really that interested in the sort of war stuff. But I think when you realize that there's a larger world out there, that you're not just going to be confined to kid stuff like Dennis the Menace and, you know, Desperate Dan and all that stuff. I remember seeing Mad Max 2 for the first time, way too young, but having the same kind of epiphany that, oh, there are, you know, there are movies for grown-ups that are going to be fucking cool, you know? And Nemesis was, I suppose, an earlier version of that because, like I said, I was 10 years old. I really, really liked drawing. I was big into dinosaurs and monster movies, Ray Harryhausen, King Kong, you know, Valley of Guanji, all that stuff. So I suppose I was going to wait later to touch upon this, but I think the important part is that, you know, when you start reading comics and you want to be an artist, you see the likes of Brian Boland and John Byrne and Dave Gibbons, Glenn Fabry, you know, realistic, really accomplished artists with really powerful styles. But it's very intimidating looking at that artwork because, you know, not everybody can draw like Brian Boland or Dave Gibbons or, you know. So I think the big epiphany was seeing O'Neill's artwork, even at 10, and realizing, wow, he like made a living doing this and it doesn't look like that artwork. Like maybe he doesn't know how to draw an elbow properly and it doesn't matter because the style of what he's doing overshadows everything else and the originality of it. And that had a huge impact on me right from the moment I first saw his artwork. And that stayed with me ever since. I mean, that's why these boys are up on the wall behind me. I mean, even to this day at 55, that stuff's just a constant inspiration to me. So it's been a huge part of my journey to, well, I'm not quite sure what this is as a destination, but I mean, yeah, I would not be here without discovering that artwork. I have no doubt about that whatsoever.
Well, we may get to some of the original artwork I can see on your wall behind you in a little while, but let's go back. So we've got a 1983 Titan edition. Both of us have got the same one. I will say that the binding on mine seems to be hanging on in there. So
Just about. I'm very careful when I open it.
Now, you come in at Prog 224. So when did you track down the Titan edition and get to read the earlier stories?
I would have been reading 2000 AD. I probably, you know, initially at that point, I would not have been aware, I would not have even considered that there were earlier stories.
Right.
And certainly in Dublin in 1981, there was nowhere to go to get back issues. You know, there were no comic shops, there were no nothing, you know. So I think it was probably a little older, probably around, I started working pretty early. I started working when I was 16. So probably around, when I had some money of my own, probably around 86, 87, I remember I'd wander into Dublin city centre and there was a weird little sort of hippie, sort of like a hippie sort of crystal store called the Alchemist's Head in Dublin. And I don't even know why I would have gone in there, but in the back behind these red curtains, like the porno section of some like video store, you went in and they had a comic section and they had all these Titan editions. And I had no idea they existed at the time. But I remember walking in and I saw the Cursed Earth collections and I assume, I can't remember if they had Nemesis there, but I assume they did. But anyway, I snatched up all of those as I could. And gradually then the world started moving in the right direction where, you know, you realized there were places you could go to get back issues and Forbidden Planet opened up in Dublin for the first time. And I had a friend of my brother who gave me all his previous collections one day. Just like, oh, I want to get rid of these. Do you want them? I was like, hell yes. And there were hundreds of them. So yeah.
Perfect. I mean, I remember there was a similar hippie head shop in Leicester. And the only reason I went in there was because they had comics in there. You know, when you get past all the other stuff that's in there, you'd find the comics and the back issues. Amazing. Remind us, in this first Titan collection, give us a sort of the story, or at least tell us where it takes, where it starts, and where it takes Nemesis up to by the end of the volume.
Okay, no pressure then. Okay. It's set in the far distant future. Earth is the center of this giant galactic xenophobic empire led by Torquo Amada, who wears a suspiciously familiar shaped helmet to really sell the concept. And the hero is a mysterious alien called Nemesis, who we never see for the longest time. We just see his spacecraft that he flies around in. And he flies around like a futuristic, I suppose, General Lee from the Dukes of Hazzard. He flies around the place, wreaking havoc, destroying the place, freeing alien prisoners. And that eventually morphs into a story where we learn more about this world. We finally see Nemesis. He kicks the shit out of lots of people. There's a fantastic, propulsive, ridiculous action sequences. And it's kind of open-ended. I mean, the story takes you on a bit of a journey, but it pretty much just ends where it continues to keep going. Nemesis defeats Torquo Amada. Spoiler alert, kills him, not for the first time. And then it comes to an end, and then we got it back about 100 issues later, and the carnage continued.
And the first story, of course, it's always weird how comic book stories start in a way, particularly in 2000 AD, where they had this idea of doing a music tie-in with the Jam single Going Underground. And Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill come up with that Terror Tube story. And I suspect, Mick, they didn't really know that this was going to be one of 2000 AD's most long-running and popular thrills.
No, I suspect you're right. Although I'll say that that's probably the greatest thing about 2000 AD back then, was you just never knew what you were going to get. And I think that lends itself as much to the people creating the stories as it does to the people reading them. I agree with you. I mean, even just trying to describe it here on this podcast to the story is kind of impossible. And then that's even before you show people the visuals. Kevin O'Neill's artwork isn't really that well known over here in the States, you know? So when you talk to people who are into comic art and stuff, I mean, they know his artwork probably primarily from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, but when you show them Nemesis, they're just like, what the fuck is that? And it's like, I know. Isn't it great? So yeah, I suppose looking back at it at the time, it seemed like some sort of maybe weird alternative to the Future Shocks at the time, that maybe they just thought they'd be these weird one-offs just based on whatever was popular in music at the time. And for whatever reason, Nemesis hit big, so I suppose they just kept going.
Yeah, and we will get to talking about the spectacular black and white artwork from Kev O'Neill in a minute. Pat Mills and his writing, I mean, he's got, obviously, some familiar themes for Pat, you know, the rebellious nature, the distrust, complete distrust of any form of organized religion, and exploring some of the darker sides of humanity. What do you make of the storytelling by Pat, first of all?
Oh yeah, I think it's great. And I like the themes. And to think about a 10-year-old reading this, it's kind of beautifully subversive, I think, you know? When you're so used to, you know, I suppose even the likes of Battle and all the stuff that was going on at the time, and I know even though they subverted the good guy, bad guy thing plenty, but I think Nemesis dresses it up so well in the story it's telling, you know? I know there's always the cliche about science fiction being used, and I know Pat Mills hates that he has to resort to sci-fi to get the themes and the things that he wants to say across. And I do get that, but when it's done this well, I mean, he's got little to complain about. I mean, it's so effective and it's so over the top. I mean, the themes kind of batter you over the head with it, but the whole thing is just so out of its mind. Like, it's dressed up so beautifully with trying to get those themes across. The storytelling's great. I mean, look, you know, Pat Mills is always great. Probably in later years, I think he wears those themes a little too blatantly, in the sense that the themes get in the way of the story rather than the other way around. But, you know, I'm not going to hold that against the man. I mean, he's given us so much, so, and his heart's in the right place, let's put it that way. So,
yeah, he's Uncle Pat.
He's a master storyteller. I mean, the kind of, it's hard to talk about him individually with this, though. The writing is whatever the writing is. It's hard to imagine it being illustrated by anybody else, though. And it's hard to imagine that it would have been as effective illustrated by anybody else. It could have been a very different strip. I mean, look what happens when Redondo picks up the pen for book two. And that's no offense to Redondo, whose artwork I love as well, but it's not a style, for me anyway, that suited this kind of story that it's telling. Although, I suppose being a bit of a purist, I'd probably level that against anyone who's followed up from O'Neill on Nemesis.
Hmm.
With a bit of a pass for Brian Talbot, but at least he made it his own. So,
and such a wonderful thing to have the human be the villain and have this weird alien warlock be a sort of hero anti-hero.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing stuff. And I always forget, until I reread it, I always forget, of course, that at the end of the Terror Tube story, Pat Mills kills off Torquemada and then realizes, of course, that he needs to bring him back and that Torquemada will always come back, you know, like a good bad guy.
I don't think it matters. I mean, the story is just so out of its mind. I just don't think any of the rules matter. I mean, you die, it doesn't matter. Of course, he's coming back. He was too good a villain. He was just far too good a villain to waste. I mean, what are we going to replace him with?
Yeah. And of course, they have some hugely significant battles, repeated battles, some great showdowns in this first volume. Before I ask you about Kev O'Neill's art, any other sort of favorite, apart from the two main protagonists, any other favorite characters in book one?
I love all of them. I honestly love, there's nothing in this book I don't love. I love Googly. I actually have a page of Googly, although I don't have it framed and hanging. I love Googly. I love the strip where we first see Nemesis, where he crashes in the village and they, you know, try and hang him and nose drip and, you know, you booby. Grobbendonk, of course, but great Uncle Baal is just the fucking man. I mean, I just love that one-off episode where he goes to visit Baal, steals Grobbendonk, and there's something about the world building in that part. What is it? It's four pages. There's something about the world building in simply that four pages where he goes to visit his uncle.
Yeah.
That is just astounding. So anyway, I love all of it, Eamon. There's no dip in this for me. I mean, it's just astounding. So,
well, let's talk about Kevin O'Neill, black and white artwork in 2000 AD with this weird and wonderful world that Pat Mills and he have created together. Now, you've said that the artwork punches you in the face when you open the book and look at it. And also that, you know, when you show it to American comic readers, it does similar things. What do you make of the artwork? Tell us a bit about it in this first volume.
Well, it's all about the world building. As I said, I mean, Mills can write whatever he wants, but this world just doesn't work as effectively with anybody else illustrating it. I mean, it's a lived-in world that you can feel from one corner to the next. You know, you can feel the stuff that's going on off-panel, which is the greatest accomplishment you can give any creative people about world building. It feels like a fully inhabited concept and that there are other things going on in this world that the story is just not focusing on at the time. I mean, that's just the greatest feeling. And, you know, Mills must have been having a great time with this stuff. When he first saw Neil's artwork come in, he must have just lost his mind when he realized what he could probably go and do with this, you know? I love the strip that is from the summer special. Oh, which I guess technically is when we first see Nemesis, it's true. Right at the end with Sir Osric on his quest. Or Sir Ulrich on his quest. The design sense is beautiful. O'Neill's not afraid to use black. Terrifying concept for an artist. Lots of black. Because you know you're going to mess it all up. But his inking is so slick, you know? There's like brushwork, and then he goes in with that little quill, and he does all that sort of furry rendering. I mean, it's just, you could just get lost in the artwork. And yeah, seeing this in color is just a waste. I mean, I know people want color artwork, but I mean, you're just losing so much when you stick color on top of this stuff, because he's already done all the hard work. It's all here. So
yeah, he famously gets colored for the Deviant edition.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's another one of these things where 2000 AD trying to sell their stuff, their books in America, need a colored version.
Yeah.
I don't know if that, you know, if that's just an urban legend or if there's actually any truth in it. But this stuff belongs in glorious black and white, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it belongs as big as possible.
Yes.
You know, I mean, these Titan books, I think they're pretty much the original 2000 AD. Issue size. I mean, the artwork itself is obviously bigger, but yeah, I mean, it has to, it's just black and white, and the bigger the better. All this beautiful zipped, all the beautiful letter tone he uses as well, you know, it just fucking genius. And so
he, I mean, you know, his weird machinery, the mad statues and buildings that appear, his spaceships, the tubes going underground. And then, of course, the weird creatures that he has, the alien creatures. And is it Brother Gogol who gets infected with...
Yes.
He's slowly turning into a creature, and he's trying to conceal it. And it's just... Would you say that Kevin O'Neill is the most shocking artist in the early period of 2000 AD?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, because, like, Nemesis is terrifying. I mean, you called him a hero, anti-hero earlier. I don't know that he's a hero.
Yeah.
I mean, he definitely an anti-hero, but, I mean, you know, where does Nemesis' moral compass sit? I mean, you know, it's, I mean, he hates humans, but, you know, and he hangs out with Purity Brown, but I sort of feel like that's as much by default as anything else. He doesn't like humans. He doesn't trust them. So,
well, just like he's the most shocking, I think, of those early artists. As you said, you've mentioned Bolland and Gibbons, who can draw beautifully, but their work is, I don't want to, you know, say too much, but is it sort of, theirs work is more conventional comic book artwork, whereas Kevin O'Neill is never conventional, is he?
No, not at all. I mean, everything, the design sense, the way he uses the panels, the way he does his storytelling. I mean, there's nothing conventional here. And if everybody talks about 2000 AD, you know, sort of channeling a sort of punk rock kind of outside the norms attitude, which pretty much all the strips did back then. I mean, there's no better example of it than Nemesis. I mean, it's just... I mean, like I said, how do you describe it?
Yeah.
You know, you just can't. The themes are there for sure, but everything is so nebulous on it. I mean, O'Neill's spaceships, even just on that basis, everything looks organic. Nothing is as it seems. And that goes as much from the storytelling to his designs to the way he tells the stories. Everything is questionable. That's fantastic.
Do you remember he did, we talk about American comics. He did, Kevin O'Neill did a Green Lantern story with Alan Moore. And I think, am I right in thinking they didn't print it originally because it was too disturbing?
I can't remember if it was that particular strip.
Certainly, I know.
But it might have been.
They said, you know, they said that Kevin O'Neill's artwork was just too disturbing. And
yes.
I remember,
yes,
I don't know if it's Kevin O'Neill or the editor who comes back and says, well, is there anything we can change? Any, you know, any bits we can white out or whatever to make it more acceptable? And they just said, no, it's the whole thing.
Yeah, it was the Comics Code Authority, I think. It
right.
It was refused for the Comics Code
there
Authority.
There we are. That was it. Yes.
Because they just, and they couldn't specifically say what. You're right. They just said, just everything about it is disturbing.
Yeah.
So, which probably explains all the covers then he did for the American Nemesis reprints, where he clearly just decided to go all in.
I mean, it's just wonderful. He starts, of course, as an art bodger, and then he grows on to become the artist on Nemesis the Warlock. Obviously, does this. Is it one of the best things to have ever appeared in the prog?
For me, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's up there with anything else. I mean, yeah. I mean, there's nothing like it. I mean, we can look at all the other stuff, and that's great. By the time Dread really gets good, by the time you get the really good artists on Dread with McMahon, and, you know, well, I suppose McMahon was sort of starting right from the start, but by the time McMahon found his own style and Dread became into his own, but Dread had been running for a long time with that. Nemesis comes out of it. Both barrels blasting straight from the first strip to keep going. I mean, right up to the end, mostly the end of the Brian Talbot. Nemesis is just a fantastic experience all the way up there. But so, yes, I think so.
Yeah. So before we get to sort of talking about specific pages of artwork, any particular moments in the first volume that stand out to you as great bits of storytelling or just great moments from 2000 AD?
Well, there's the cover for Prog 178. Let's just call it what it is. If that's a cover that's not going to get you to buy a comic, then you're dead inside. I love the giant Concorde bird that just starts attacking the train in Killer Watt and then flies off to try and feed its young that are living at the top of an old skyscraper. The second page of Nemesis' first real strip.
Yeah.
And there's this panel with this giant spacecraft flying over this alien land. The sense of scale that it's selling. He's drawn the giant shadow on the ground underneath, and of course everybody's terrified and all that stuff. I love this page too. This is my introduction to Nemesis, but you know, it's one page that covers the whole thing. Torquemada is back. There's the two old codgers in the crowd, and the guard's like, "Rejoice!" And he's like, "Oh yeah, hail Torquemada, yeah." I love all the, Eamon, I don't even know where to start, you know? I mean, there's just, there's this cover. I mean,
yeah.
Come on. Come on, just bring it. Oh, and then of course, we were talking about Brother Gogol, but, got this.
That's the I am the Nemesis, I am the Warlock image.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, as we've said, he's the sort of anti-hero. It's a very disturbing image for 10 and 12-year-olds in a comic book in the early 80s. I wonder how, in a way, and I sort of wonder how they got away with it without complaints. Presumably, all these kids sitting in the back of cars just reading away and nobody's really paying any attention to what we were reading.
I think that's pretty much it. I just don't think anybody noticed what we were reading. I mean, my folks wouldn't have picked it up. And my folks, actually, they wouldn't have cared anyway. They were pretty easy going with that stuff. But I mean, they just would have had no reason to pick it up. I mean, I think as far as they were concerned, comics are just, it's just Dennis the Menace.
Yeah.
You know, little did they know. So,
or it's, you know, the rebooted Dan Dare. There's Judge Dredd, and he's a cop who shoots bad guys, so that's all right. They probably didn't know that we were reading Nemesis the Warlock, having our minds blown by the concepts and the artwork. Yeah, amazing stuff.
I don't think they'd have understood. I mean, I showed my ma The Simpsons one time, and she just couldn't get past the fact that they were yellow.
Right.
So she couldn't even focus on the show. She was just like, yeah, but why are they yellow? And I'm like, it doesn't matter. Just watch the show. And she's like, yeah, but like, they're yellow. Like, why? So yeah, I mean, what would have happened if they picked up Nemesis? I just don't think they would have understood what was happening.
Do you enjoy, I mean, that's perhaps a silly question, but do you enjoy the final battle in this volume, the sword fight, the famous duel on the weird structures that Kevin O'Neill has drawn?
Yeah, I actually do. Not surprisingly.
It's astonishing stuff, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it just upends everything. I mean, it's just a great fight sequence. You know, you see all the way, you know, Marvel and DC and superhero shit does this kind of stuff. And I'm not even bagging on that, but there's a real intimacy to this kind of storytelling. I love the first page. I love that spread where it has Nemesis versus Torquemada, and it has Nemesis on one side and Torquemada on the other side. And then it just breaks these panels down into... it just breaks these panels down into sort of specific real-time fighting. It's not like the Hulk fighting something where the Hulk does a punch and then they're somewhere else and then they're somewhere else. Nemesis swings a sword and smashes a statue, and then Torquemada retorts and gets Nemesis in the arm, and then Nemesis kicks him in the head. Like, it's the kind of storytelling I suppose they tell you not to do when you're doing this kind of thing, but I mean, it just works so well. There's such a great energy to it. And you just feel the movement. This stuff moves.
Mm.
When you look at the panels, it's moving for you, which is the dream. You know, as any artist, that's what you want people to experience, the energy of it. They're not just static poses.
And I know we talked about him disturbing us with his artwork, but in this sort of climactic battle in the end of volume one, Kevin O'Neill just seems to turn it up to 11. Every panel becomes a beautiful work of art. Mind-boggling stuff going on in the background. The weird structures they're fighting on, those statues, the alien creatures. It's just, there's Kirby crackle in there and all sorts of stuff going on. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, look at that for a grail page.
Where
Torquemada starts jumping from one dead body to the other.
Yeah, and he's in the Grim Reaper body. Yeah.
You know, everything in the strip is terrifying. I wouldn't last 5 minutes in this world. I think the thing that's so great is they're so well matched.
Yeah.
As adversaries. You know, it's not a case of Spider-Man fighting, I don't remember who the villain was, who's got like spikes on the soles of his feet, which never really made any sense to me. How does he even walk around? But these guys are so well matched physically, mentally. They're just great foils for each other. And you so rarely get that in a satisfying way.
Yeah. Let's get to Grail pages. But before we do that, on your wall behind you, you've got some Kevin O'Neill artwork, I believe.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes, I do. Well, okay. Hold on. Here, I'm going to take this off the wall.
Ooh.
Yeah, it must have been around 87, 88. And my older brother to London. And we went to Kingsreach Tower, and I left in a portfolio of work that you will not be surprised to learn I did not get hired. But we went to, I think it was Comic Showcase after, and they had nothing but 2008 artwork. Eamon, racks of it. Mm. And they had this puppy for the princely sum of £35.
Wow.
And I snapped that puppy up, and I've had it ever since. I bought a page from Bank Company as well, Brett Owen's page. And that was like 15. So I think I had £50 in total when I bought this. So yeah, so I've had this. This has come with me everywhere. It was in Dublin. It came to LA with me, all of it. And I love it. Listen, we could talk about O'Neill's artwork too were blue in the face, but until you're looking at the original artwork up close, where you can see the brush strokes, where you can see the pen, you can see the mistakes, you can see the pencil underneath. I mean, I'd leave everything else in the house, including the cats, to rescue this first if the house caught fire.
So just to tell listeners, that is from the first Titan volume. It's right at the end. It's page 94. It's Torquemada dying with an "I will return." And then Nemesis falls through the dimension portal. I'm not sure this has happened terribly often on the podcast, Mick, but you actually own a Grail page from this volume.
I actually own 3 Grail pages from this volume.
Oh.
And frankly, if I won the fucking lottery, I would own as many of them as I could. I own it. So that's the page. The other page I have here is the page before that.
Oh, nice.
So it is Nemesis jumping off the bridge, but Torquemada has him by the harpoon cable. And then there's a close-up of both their eyes. And then Nemesis pulls Torquemada and goes, "Enjoy me, vile human." And then Torquemada gets pulled into the flames. Now, I bought that a couple of years ago off Dale, who purveyor of all things 2000 AD artwork, for considerably more than £35. But the thought of reuniting these two pages together for probably the first time since 1981 was really just too much. It was just too much to take, and I begged Dale. I begged him for it. He did not want to sell it, and I don't blame him. But once I told him I had the other page here, these two pages together, like long-lost lovers. Come on, you know. So he relented, and I think he sold it to me for less than he wanted, but, hey, you know.
Well, you've reunited the pages. They are probably, I'm guessing, that's from Prog 244, right at the end of the volume.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah, the conclusion exactly right. Of the battle between Nemesis and Torquemada. Absolutely astonishing that you have there, those two glorious pieces of black and white Kevin O'Neill artwork. Honestly, well, it does throughout this book, there are such wonderful images, but it doesn't get much better than those two pages, Mick.
It kind of doesn't. And I couldn't believe, I honestly couldn't believe it happened. I mean, look, Eamon, this is how seriously I take Nemesis. When Dale agreed to sell me that page of artwork, I'm sure I shed a manly fucking tear just at the thought of reuniting these pages.
Right.
You know, there was something magical about that thought, that O'Neill had drawn these together, probably under a tight deadline, as I'm sure everything is when it comes to this business. And then just the thought of however many years later that they're sort of back together and on a wall together. And I'll probably bury them with me in a Viking funeral. No one's ever getting them. So... no one's ever getting them.
Astonishing. So pages 93 and 94 you own. You said you got a third page.
I do, but I don't have it handy here. It's away, but it is. It's a page. I got it a couple of years ago. It's a page with Purity Brown and Googly running through termite, trying to escape the termite. It's Eamon.
It's that page. Right.
It is one.
Astonishing.
It's where we see this amazing fucking shot of the two huge cities that have been built into the abyss, mausoleum and necropolis. And then it's got that. Yeah, I mean, look, it's got Purity and Googly. Oh, I think we lost him, Purity. And Googly know how aliens feel. He hate Torquemada too. Then there's that fantastic shot here where the Terminator appears out of nowhere and fires at them, but he's upside down because he's got, you know, because nothing matters in this world. You can just stand upside down on a bridge. But there's just a vicious energy to that shot with the Terminator. And I actually remember as a kid, I used to look at that panel all the time, wondering how he drew it, wondering how he knew how to draw that and to make it do that. Because then in that panel with the Terminator, and Googly says, "There's no time to use the bridge." in that panel in the lower left corner, there's just some dude sitting in his apartment reading like a newspaper, like, oh, what's going on outside there? Like,
looking out the window. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a guy at the bus stop. Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, he does these mad twisted, you know, the mad twisted tubes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's astonishing. That is page 45.
Page 45.
In
that's right.
The Titan Volume 1, which fortunately does have the page numbers. And I will post all those images when this episode comes out. And they're not even Grail pages because you've got them.
Well, there are still. Here's the best thing. I'm delighted to own these. Like, I feel honored. I feel honored to own them. It feels so. I don't know what the word is. I just feel really lucky to own them. But in saying all that, Eamon, there are so many Grail pages in here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah.
Well, let's give you a couple more. But before we do that, just quick shout out to Comic Showcase back in the late 80s with that artwork. If we had a Blitz spear that could travel in time, we'd go back there and buy so much.
When you think about the pricing, and nobody really had any value on this stuff.
No,
it was just like, yeah, just get rid of it. What are we doing with this? Here, this place will sell it. Just flog it off. And I don't even know, you know, you read Brian Boland talking about how he got so little of his artwork back from IPC.
Yeah.
So it does make you wonder, like, did O'Neill even know this artwork was getting sold? I mean, I work on Family Guy, so I know the whole basis of work for hire. You know, it's like, hey, you know what? We pay you. You do the artwork. We own it. Blah, 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 blah. You know? Yeah, I mean, that's just how it was for them, too. So, but yeah, that must have burned, particularly in later years where comic artwork suddenly became such a commodity.
When it started to take off and explode in value, yeah. And Comic Showcase, of course, no longer there. The hippie head shop in Leicester, no longer there. I'm guessing the little hippie shop in Dublin, probably no longer there.
Long gone.
Long gone.
One of the guys who worked there was in an Irish band called the Golden Horde. And no, long gone.
All those places. Oh, well. Okay, Mick, come on then. Let's up the ante and give you another page or a cover or so from this volume. What are you going to pick for the Grail Page Gallery?
All right, the Grail Page Gallery. Okay, well, listen, I'll pick this simply because it would make the perfect trifecta, but I will pick the final page of book one.
There you go. That's the one you want to add to the first two, yeah.
Just to have Nemesis getting that Blitz Spear and fly off. But all this, like, look at all that beautiful sort of side paneling and, you know.
It's like an illustrated manuscript.
Yeah, exactly. All the stuff at the bottom, you know, I love it when O'Neill puts his own lettering in on the pages. You know, he sometimes sneaks in his own lettering for the sound effects and stuff. And even just the way he does those E's where it says the end of book one, he always did those sort of weird triangular E's that I always try to fit in. There is the Grim Reaper Grail page because, of course, there is. It is the... I remember getting to that page, reading that story, and thinking, how in the name of fuck am I going to survive the next 7 days to see what happens next? You know, there's that cover.
Yeah.
You know.
So that's the famous cover to 22, is it 229? Oh,
that is the one, 239.
239,
Where they felt it was too phallic.
Yes. So there's Torquemada and Nemesis, the sword fight on the weird bridge thing between the two statues. They had to move the bridge up because they didn't want it coming out of the pelvis. Nemesis versus Torquemada,
the thing that really sells, I'm sure the big problem is that the statues look like they are living. They look alive.
Like they look like they're part of it.
Everything looks organic. So, I mean, they both look like they're looking down, watching the fight. So, yeah, it's ridiculous, but it's also hilarious.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then, so many. Hold on, I'm trying to look for it here. I assume this cover is here. I think it's Probe 238, and it's got the, no, it's actually not, it's not in this collection, actually, but Probe 238, and it's got Nemesis in the circle in the middle, and then he's just surrounded by this bevy of aliens, and it just says, Nemesis is back! And I always wanted to get that circle image tattooed on me somewhere, and I will still someday. I just haven't gotten around to it yet, so...
So there's your cover. There's three extra pages to go with the three pages you already own from this first book. I don't think we've stood on any toes there because I think those images are all still fair game in the Grail Page game. So fantastic. But of course, as you said, the whole book's a Grail Page. Every single page.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, no, I suppose anything from the Uncle Baal episode two, that first episode, the first page, where he's just sitting in the chair making his potion, you know, and of course the chair is alive. It's a skeleton, and you know,
it's great.
It's too hard a question.
You've given me a nice selection that I can post along with posting images of the three pages from this volume that you do own already, which are astonishing and. I'm sure myself and all the listeners send our congratulations and our envy towards you for those.
I can make this a little bit worse if you want.
Go on then. Oh, hang on. Mick turns around and finds something else.
You're not going to like this. You ready for this, Em?
I'm ready. Yep. You've got another piece of original artwork from your wall. And
commission.
You've got a Nemesis commission from... It's a recreation of a Page commission, is it?
No, it's just... He just did his own thing.
He's done everything on there.
He has sliced my head off, and he's holding my head in his hand and says, "Now behave, Brother Cassidy." An ex-girlfriend... one of my best friends was the manager of Forbidden Planet in Dublin.
Right.
In the 90s. And got to talk to Kevin O'Neill because they were trying to bring him over for a signing. And my ex-girlfriend at the time got in touch with my buddy who got in touch with Kevin O'Neill and asked, would he do a commission? And I guess he doesn't do a lot of them. And then this puppy arrived in the mail a couple of weeks later. And holy shit, man. It is. And I thought I'd lost it for years. I couldn't find it for years. And I thought... You know, because I got married over here and then I got divorced and everything got sort of upended and where is everything? And I went for a couple of years without it and I really thought I'd lost it. And then finally got settled, started unpacking everything. There it was in the back of a portfolio box. Fantastic.
And now it's framed danced around and on your office wall.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, Mick. We're very jealous.
Sorry, Em.
No worries. do you have a comic art fans page where you've got some of this art displayed?
I think I have them up on comic art fans, but I haven't been there in years. I also had a spread from book three, but I sold that. It was the one with Mechquake sitting telling the brother that he doesn't think that's a very good idea. But I actually sold that a couple of years ago because, needs must and all that. And I was very sorry to let it go, but it's not book one. So right. I felt okay.
Astonishing. Let us say that Nemesis book one, the Titan edition, you'll find it on eBay. You should have the Titan edition, but it's been collected... So many times, particularly now, they're doing the definitive editions, which I think there's now four volumes of. And the first one, you can get it digitally for £8 on the Kindle, I noticed. I hadn't actually got any of the definitive editions, I think, because I've got the Titans.
I have the Titan, and then this came out, remember, as a hardback, as Death to All Aliens. And I have that one. Well, that one's in work, actually. But and that one's a great one, too. Because the binding is better and the paper's slightly better quality. It's really crisp. And of course, it's a hardback, which makes it all look really important and dashing.
Yeah. Well, as we've said, one of the greatest things to ever appear in 2000 AD, one of the greatest creations by Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill. His artwork is shocking and exciting at the same time. And it's scary, isn't it? I mean, it's a strange thing for a boys' science fiction comic in the 80s, but it was quite scary stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's terrifying. I mean, it is terrifying. It's a terrifying universe to create. You don't want to live there.
Yeah.
There's no good place to live. You don't want to live with the aliens. You don't want to live with the humans. Maybe there's some little hippie commune off somewhere in the far corner of the galaxy that nobody discovered yet, where aliens and humans are living together and frolicking through the meadows. But I don't think so.
No.
It just doesn't. That doesn't seem like Pat Mills. It doesn't seem like Pat or Kevin would be remotely interested in that story. It's a terrifying world. I can't really pay a higher compliment, I think, especially as you get older and look back at this artwork and just how sort of breathtaking it is in terms of its originality. But I compare O'Neill to H.R. Giger, I mean, without a qualm, you know, and Mobius. That's the kind of... It's just breathtaking. You've never seen anything like it when you first see it. And I've never seen anything like it since. You know, there's plenty of, well, I won't say clones, but I would say plenty of artists who were clearly inspired by the likes of O'Neill. You know, you look at Bisley's artwork, you look at a lot of the, you know, and the sort of wave of artists that followed in Bisley's wake. But, you know, Bisley must have looked a lot at Kevin O'Neill's artwork.
Yeah.
You know, particularly when you look at that first run of ABC Warriors where he was doing it in black and white and ink. All the in-jokes are in there, all the sort of funny graffiti on the wall in the background, that sort of same weird sense of humor. Where any real emotional attachment is just incinerated by the artwork. I guess I was thinking about when Bisley draws Terry's death scene in, you know, the ABC Warriors. And like up to that point, they've sort of intimated that she's in love with this robot and they're sort of delving into the sort of weird themes of could a human who thinks she's a robot really love a robot. But then she just gets crushed by a rock and Bisley draws it in this sort of cartoony, comedic kind of fashion. Hammerstein picks up the rock and just goes, oops, you know, or oop. No, like Nemesis is the precursor of all that stuff.
Yeah.
There's no room for any warmth or emotion in here. It's a cruel, cruel universe they've created. And like I said, I don't know that Nemesis is any glowing moral compass compared to the villains in there. It happens to be that the villains are worse than him. That's the only thing.
Yeah.
That sort of by default makes Nemesis the good guy. But I wouldn't trust him.
Amazing. Well, it's been fantastic going back to the very first volume, book one of Nemesis the Warlock. Guest project time, Mick. Tell us about, because you said you submitted a portfolio.
Well,
tell us a little bit about your own work and where you are, you know, where it's got you now, what you work on at the moment.
Yeah, no, I was 16, 17 at the time. So, and I was obviously wanted to be the next Kevin O'Neill or Simon Bisley or Glenn Fabry at the time. I mean, just fantastic artists that were really inspirational. So yeah, I went over to King's Tower with a portfolio of just what I assume would be pretty terrible examples of artwork. I don't actually have them anymore, and I really, really wish I had. I remember the day I just took all my old artwork and thought, no, don't need that anymore, bundled it all up and threw it in the bin. But I really wish I kept all that stuff because, I really wanted to do comics. I ended up working in animation in Dublin. I loved drawing. I just drew all the time. And I was terrible in school. Just fucking terrible. An absolute nightmare. Never did homework. Never did work. Never gave a shit about it. And Don Bluth upped sticks from the US and they got a deal with the Irish government, a big tax break to open up an animation studio in Dublin. And look, I don't need to tell you, Eamon. I mean, we're of a similar vintage, I'm sure. Growing up in mid to late 80s Dublin and telling people that you wanted to be an artist for a living was, you might as well tell people you wanted to be a fucking astronaut, you know? It's like, yeah, okay, sure, whatever. But, you know, so I got the opportunity to work there, and I got to skip out of school a year early. That's how shit I was in school. The school were delighted to see the back of me too. And I've never really looked back. I got a job at Bluth. I worked on a bunch of movies with them. I was in London for a while. I was back in Bluth. I was in Phoenix, Arizona for a while. I was back in Dublin. And then I've been in LA now since about 1998. And I've been in animation the whole time. And I'm currently a character designer on Family Guy. So,
yeah, you work on Family Guy, who I can see some of the models behind you.
Yeah. This summer, I'm actually on Family Guy 22 years,
right,
ever since its resurrection in 2004. And it's been great. It's a great, it's a fun show to work on, great crew. I mean, you know, yes, it's not exactly Kevin O'Neill beating, not exactly Nemesis beating the shit out of, you know, human Terminators and stuff, but there's a sensibility to the show that I do feel slots nicely into all this classic stuff from 2000 AD, just willing to rip the piss out of everything and subvert expectations and stuff. So in that regard, I do feel like I'm kind of in a place where I'm supposed to be. So yeah, the ghost of Kevin looms large over it all.
Fantastic. Helped you get where you are.
Yeah.
By punching you in the face with black and white artwork.
Like the last couple of years, I've actually managed to get a couple of Metallica tour posters as well. And that's just been a great, came to it late, you know what I mean? So I mean, I'm in my 50s now. So, I mean, I would have loved to be doing that stuff back when I was a teenager in my 20s, monsters and skulls and all that stuff. But it's great to get to it at this age and really get to scratch that itch, you know, that this book really kicked off. So to just be let loose now and just have nobody breathing down your neck telling you what to draw, but it all fits nicely into all the stuff that you love. Death, destruction, flaming skulls, monsters, werewolves on motorcycles, all that stuff. It's the dream lives, man.
Amazing. Well, we can see some of your artwork if we follow you on Instagram, which I do, at Metal Mongrel. Link in the show notes. But also you've got a big cartel with some of your illustrations up there.
Yeah, that would be selling the Metallica posters. They're mostly sold out. And then I have a website, which is just metalmongrel.com.
Right.
And that should just take you there, and you can all go and laugh at my meager attempts to step in the shoes of the master himself. So...
Well, I'll put three links in the show notes to your Instagram, your big cartel, and your website, so people can have a look at some of your artwork that we'll be talking about. And if I can find it, I will put your Comic Art Fans page in as well, so that people can see the Nemesis commission and pages that you own from book one.
I see you gritting your teeth, Eamon. So.
I mean, it's astonishing. We've never had a situation where somebody owns three pages from the book we're talking about.
I think we've had
one, maybe, where, you know, they've had one page. But yeah, astonishing stuff, Mick.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, I don't fuck around with this stuff, Eamon. I go in deep.
You're serious. Well, yeah. Thank you so much for picking Nemesis book one in the Titan collection. By Pat Mills and Kevin O'Neill, just a barnstormer. If you've not got the Titan collection, track one down before they all disappear and fall apart.
Yeah, you're missing out. Seriously, it's the way it's meant to be seen.
Thank you so much, Mick.
Thank you, Eamon. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As ever, find all of these links we've been talking about at megacitybookclub.com. Follow me on all the socials in order to see some of Mick's artwork that he owns, and you can drool over. And email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. If you've got a book, a creator, a character, or a story you want to come on and talk about. So until next time, we have to say be pure, be vigilant, behave, and goodbye from me and...
Goodbye from me. Take it easy, folks. Wow.